It's another episode of your favourite gardening podcast, Talking Heads, with me, Saul Walker.
And me, Lucy Chamberlain.
So, settle down for the next 30 minutes or so and let us entertain you with haughty talk. And of course, being the Talking Heads podcast, discussions about the weather. Winter is here, and with it, we enter the season of structure and form.
We also grab our Gore-Tex jackets, pruning saws, leaf blowers, chainsaws, and trusty secateurs as our gardening projects switch from tending all that abundant growth to tidying and shaping it with creativity and precision. Winter really is the season to renovate, renew, and revive our estates, large and small.
So, whether you gaze over orchards, paddocks, meadows, and woods, or patios, pots, veggie patches and flower beds, you can trust Lucy and myself to keep you entertained with the latest news from our industry and updated on key jobs for the season. Never let it be said that our jobs quieten down for the winter months.
Settle back into this latest episode as we take you inside the busy and exciting world of the modern head gardener. Hello, stranger.
Oh,
hello,
my lord. Oh my gosh. That's what you look like.
Wow, it's been a little while, hasn't it, since we recorded in the old school way of sitting here having a Zoom. I did remember seeing you in London a couple of weeks ago at the Garden Press event.
Oh, that was you.
That was,
yes,
me,
I remember.
Yeah, you were the one with the beard. So the yeah, unmistakable beard. So yeah, and thanks to everybody who contributed to that episode. We had some really nice interviews there. Thoroughly enjoyable to see everybody. And I know you had a great time as well, Saul, didn't you? So
It was a bit of a running dash up and back from Plymouth. But it was a good day. I haven't been for a long time to the press event. It has changed quite significantly. It's far more of an event, I must say, than it used to be. Just used to be a lot of people sitting there sort of talking to journalists. Now it feels a little bit more upbeat. So yeah, lovely day.
Yeah,
lovely
it's very structured, and there's lots and lots of stuff to see. And thank you also, Willie, for waiting for a week for us to get the episode out. Between Saul and myself, we were ridiculously busy, and I think we still are, aren't we?
Do you know, February has been, it must be the busiest start I've had for a long time. I don't know whether we're now completely over COVID, that whole weird moment, that we're now properly back into a proper garden year schedule, that everyone's coming out of the woodwork and they want a piece of you, they want a piece of me. We are doing talks, we're in London, we're here, we're there, we've got the shows about to start. It does feel like an incredibly busy start to the year, and I know you and me are... Yeah, snowed under.
I'm at capacity. I think what I've established is that I'm at capacity. I have established my capacity, my threshold. Mm. I teetered over that the other week and had to pare back a few things. And now I'm a bit more on an even keel. I do know that for me, up until the end of March, I am ridiculously busy with a lot of deadlines for a project I'm on. And I will be glad when April hits very much because I can actually get back into the garden. I have been doing gardening paid work, but my own garden at home, I've done some, but I don't feel like I've really bedded in there yet. And I'm desperate to. You know how much I love it. And I've been doing the bare essentials, and I'd much rather go in there and really savour it. It's been very skimmy lately. But I have had, not being negative, I had a lovely day today. I have been down the road at Langenhoe with Mr. Chamberlain.
All right.
We both took on a job, and it was pruning some roses for a friend. They love their roses. And he did say to me that they'd got a few. they definitely had a few. I have spent all day speed pruning because I only had the one day to allocate to him. So I've been pruning, I think probably about 25 roses, some of them climbers, hybrid teas, shrub roses, all sorts of things. And then also some minaret fruit trees. There are about a dozen of those. And I had the delicious experience of being able to prune but not have to pick up my prunings. Now, you will know what that is like because Ian very kindly, because I'm the snipper, so he's the tidier upper.
Oh, you did have someone pick it. You didn't just leave it. And then charge the double.
Well, I did. I did leave it, but luckily Ian picked everything up. So that was delightful. But I hadn't been to this garden for well over gosh, probably about 4 or 5 years. So I had very, very distant memories of it. And isn't it funny when you go to someone's garden for the day and you turn up in your car with all your, in your van with all your pruning stuff, and you jump out and you get, you know, you cast your eye around, you get an idea of the garden. By the time you've left that garden, the full working day later, you know corners of that garden intimately because you've been stood there for 20 minutes, half an hour, pruning these plants, tying them in. You really feel so connected to that garden. I love it. And there were robins singing. The garden is full of bulbs. The daffodils were there. The wood anemones, hellebores, crocus. Oh, do you know what? And there was a misty start, but it all burnt through. And it was lovely. To top it all off, also, this customer, his wife cooked us some cheese scones.
Hey, well,
boom.
That sounds
there
like that's the kind of client you want to keep on the books, to be honest, Lucy. And I've got to say, at least it wasn't raining because I don't know what it's been like for you, but for me, February has been almost the complete write-off. 21 days consecutive rain down here in Devon.
Now, look, we've got 5.5 minutes into this podcast before we talked about the weather.
Well, yeah, what kind of podcast
that's
is this?
A record.
Yeah, that's true.
That is a record for us. But no, actually, you're leaning on an open door. I know Essex is normally dry, but God, it's not been. It's been so wet. The garden we were at today, although we're on pure sand, the garden at Langenhoe is on heavy clay and it's also low lying.
Right.
And we had to be really careful. I had to, because I was to-ing and fro-ing to the compost heap to put the prunings aside there. And you know when you've treaded the path a few times and then you start churning the ground up with your feet? And so I had to make sure I kept choosing different paths because it was so soft underfoot, ridiculously so.
Yeah. And,
ridiculously so.
And the plants, the grass, everything is on its way. Like you say, spring is definitely in the air and we just need to get loads more work done. So I'm hoping for dryness. Dry day today, yesterday, that's good. We've got dry day tomorrow. That might be the first time in months that we've had 3 days in a row. So it's all, fingers crossed. Spring is finally with us. I've just jinxed everything there, haven't I? apologies,
listeners.
You do
have a habit of saying these things out loud.
I don't.
catastrophe is imminently on your heels. But I'm sure everything will be fine, Saul. You'll be steaming ahead. March is here, but you'll feel on top of your jobs.
Yeah.
Completely in control. And you'll just be kicking back, drinking tea, eating hobnobs.
You've obviously worked us. No, Easter is very close by. It's quite early this year, which doesn't help that feeling of impending doom that you haven't really got on with as much as you should have. So, dry weather, that's all we need.
Talking of early, now all I was going to say to you is the conversation we had at lunchtime today with the customer was about spring and is it early, is it late? Because that is the conversation on everyone's lips at this time of year because things are starting to move. And we all like, so the only thing I can tell you on that as a measure is that I photograph our forsythia and various other indicator plants in our garden every year. And then I check back on my phone to see when it was in full flower. We're 2 weeks earlier this year.
They're saying we're
about in full flower now.
Saying we're about 4 weeks early down here. I can confirm that some of the plants, our Fritillaria meleagris is out, the snake's heads. That's been flowering for almost 2 weeks now. So that's very, very early for here. Yeah. The one thing I'm noticing is not just things that are very early. They're actually going over reasonably quickly as well, which isn't helping.
Because of the mildness.
Yeah. I think we're going to have quite a gap between the usual spring-summer interface, which is probably where I'm going to get all the work done, to be honest. So we'll see how it goes. But things are early. Things are quite quick. It is meant to be getting cooler during March. So that'll be an interesting thing. You've got to remember, 2018, wasn't it? Beast from the East,
happened. We've been talking about
either,
that a lot.
Last week or next week, I think, in terms of anniversary. So it can happen. Can all turn around very quickly.
The magnolias are shuddering at that thought.
Yeah, I'm jinxing things. I apologise to all the listeners.
Are you in full magnolia yet or not?
Sorry?
Are you in full magnolia yet or is it still a bit
early? Yeah, no. We are in mostly all the magnolias apart from our cross feature, Peter Veitch has flowered. So, yeah, and most of them are starting to just sort of go over, which is...
Are they?
I want to enjoy them.
Are early. I do want to enjoy them
a little bit more. Yeah. We'll see. We'll see how it goes. Yeah. It's just a very weird weather spot, isn't it? Anyway, let's go on to something else.
Enough weather talk. We've got a thank you, haven't we? Yes.
We have got a thank you to give. This is a little bit over time, so I apologise to Alan Ayton. Now, this is a name you might recognise. Yeah, I knew you might recognise. So let me read it. It says, "Hi, guys. I was shocked recently to hear my Instagram message being read out on your podcast relating to Lucy being in Australia. Maybe only up that I've listened to every episode." Well, well done, Alan. "So with that in mind, please buy yourself a coffee or a plant, all three, or a G&T, all four. Cheers. Thanks again for your outstanding horticultural waffle. Regards, Alan Ayton." Now, I don't know where he lives. Let me get this right. Australia has some of the weirdest place names. Tangambalanga.
I won't do that. I'm trying to check back into my Instagram messages, but it's going to be buried.
That's in Victoria, Australia. So thank you, Alan. He's bought us some plants. And yeah.
Can I tell you an interesting fact about Alan?
What, that he lives in Tangambalanga? Isn't enough.
He's left-handed.
Oh, right.
There you go. He's left-handed because I did a photo the other day and put my left-handed secateurs out there. I always pop my secateurs in for a bit of scale, proportion, and a bit of colour. And he recognised them because he's also left-handed. So there you go. We like to add a little bit of extra detail to our listeners, so to really personalise the experience. That's what makes us a podcast that stands separate from the rest.
Especially our ones from Tangambalanga.
Hello, Alan. Well, good morning, Alan, I think, because it's 8 o'clock at night here.
That's it.
Just waking up. So.
And it's always nice to know that we are being listened to around the world. And talk about around the world. Great segue. I have today been down to the Eden Project in Cornwall.
You left the county.
Yeah, I left. I went west. Not often do I get to cross the bridge. I'm not. You have to have a passport to get across to Cornwall. But down to the Eden Project, and those who haven't been before, it's a fantastic place. You've probably seen the biomes, the massive bubbles that they have that contain the rainforest.
So
and Mediterranean environments. But I was there because they are just opening a brand new nursery there called the Growing Point Nursery, in which they're hoping to grow lots of lovely stuff. And what's very nice is I managed to grab 10 minutes with Flo, who is running the project or is the team leader there. And here's a little snippet of the interview that I had with her all about the new nursery. Well, I've just had a wonderful tour around the new Growing Point Nursery here at the Eden Project. And I'm here with Flo Mansbridge, who is the nursery team leader. Team leader, get that right. And it's really interesting what you're trying to do here. So I wonder, Flo, if you could just explain why the Growing Point Nursery has come around and what you're trying to achieve in terms of the Eden Project itself.
Yeah, so Growing Point, the whole reason behind it is to be as self-sufficient in plants as possible. So every team who needs plants at the Eden Project goes through us. That's the whole intention. So our top priority at the moment is supplying plants for our retail shop. So we're currently on about 90% of our indoor house plants. So that's one of our top priorities. But then producing food for the chefs, so seasonal produce, all year round produce. And then last but not least is looking after the living collection. So any plants that are required for the biomes, outdoor gardens, outer estates, will receive propagation requests from those teams and then we'll produce the plants for them.
And what's really interesting is in most nurseries of this scale, what's it about? 4 acres?
6,900 square metres.
Okay, I won't translate that into acres as I have no idea, but you've got about 7-8 zones, I think, of different, obviously you can vary those climatically. But what's interesting is you've got both, like you were saying, production horticulture here, you've got productive, so you're producing vegetables, and then you're also trying to keep the botanic conservation status of the collection going. Do you find that a real struggle to balance in a space like this?
I'd be lying if I didn't say it's not challenging, but it also keeps it really, really interesting, growing so many different plants. So yes, a lot of spreadsheets are going on and trying to time it so not everything happens at once. But yes, I think it is definitely challenging doing it all under one roof. But yes, it seemed like the best option for us.
Yeah, it's interesting. We should say you've only been open about a year.
Yeah, so we started setting up just a year ago. Yes, because it was February 2023. And we're still in the process of setting up because we're running the nursery at the same time, because obviously we're already supplying plants for the shop and online sales. But we've still got some houses we need to finish setting up. So
yeah, you've got the tomato bags all ready for the tomatoes. I know you've got some cucumbers going. And then next to it, weirdly, you've got a load of bananas. And then over there, the papaya plants. It's all a bit of a mix of different plants and bits and pieces.
So we're trying to do the different zones. So as you mentioned, the tomatoes. So that's our seasonal produce section. So we've got about 900 tomato plants going in this year. And then cucumbers, aubergines, bell peppers, that's all our seasonal produce. So height of the summer, what we'll be sending down to the chefs. And then, like you say, then we've got the bananas and lemongrass. So this section is a bit of an experiment, seeing what we can grow using the heat of the geothermal, but that will tolerate the lower light levels in the winter. So we think tropical crops should do quite well in this environment. Mm. And then following on from that, we've got raised beds where we're producing salad leaves on a continuous cycle for the chef. So we're producing that all year round.
Yeah, a lot going on. Now, you mentioned geothermal, which is really interesting. When I've been to facilities like this for commercial nurseries or even places like our botanic gardens, they all have boilers. They used to be gas or oil. Many of them have switched over to biomass, obviously, to make them more sustainable. This is probably the first nursery I've been to that is actually running fully on geothermal heat. Mm-hmm. Do you want to explain a bit about the geothermal plant here, Ida? I know it's reasonably new. You've only had it a few years, but now it's running both the nursery and the biomes, isn't it?
Yes, this is definitely not my forte, but we are all connected to geothermal. So they've drilled 4 kilometres down to, which I still can't get my head around.
That's not a hand drill, is it? Someone's got a big drill for that.
I can't remember where they had to bring in this drill, but yes, it's quite a moment. A big lorry just for a drill. So that extracts the heat from that at that depth, and then that's on a, it travels through heating hot water. We're on a loop up at the greenhouse, so there's a different loop for the green for the nursery and then a different one for the biomes and offices.
Yeah, I just think that's really interesting. And you keep it around, what you're saying, 80-90 degrees in here?
Yeah, so the propagation house will keep that one minimum 18 and then the rest minimum 15. And then we've got sections that we haven't got heated so that we can produce hardier plants as well.
Okay. Yeah, and that just must... Well, I've got to say, one of the big overheads with commercial nurseries is heat. So that must really make this a lot more sustainable. And I know that's something that you're trying to do throughout almost everything you're trying to do here. Obviously, you're feeling your way, as you said, it's about a year old, but the more you can get... the sustainability message within the growing, for example, growing the house plants here, which it doesn't happen at many major gardens. No. Most of them buy them in from Holland.
And that's exactly what we're trying to stop. Yeah, we don't want the retail shop buying them in from Holland. We have to, you know, do the right thing, what we think is the right thing. So.
Yeah, and having the space to do that is absolutely fantastic. But there are a few things that you were just talking about with us. Obviously, with your raised beds and your tomatoes, you're still bringing in things like coir. And I know you're using the Melcourt wood chip compost. But you're thinking you might have enough from your own composting facilities for the future?
Possibly not for the whole nursery, but certainly for food production. We're very much, that's the aim, is that we'll be using our own composting system for growing produce. Yeah, I think for house plants, we're way, way off that because it has to be so stable. And yeah, we need to be extremely confident to sell plants in our own compost. But yeah.
Yeah, because going to people's houses, aren't they? Exactly. So you want to make sure. And rainwater harvesting, is that being done all the way through the system? And are you using that? Are you totally, especially for the last few months, it's been horrendous. Yeah, we're probably full. Oh, we could have filled it all up again. But is that something you're hoping to use more and more?
Yeah, so the plan is that we will always only use rainwater. So we've got a huge lagoon that's just the other side of the nursery. So the way the nursery's built is these big channels in the roof, so it's extremely efficient at harvesting rainwater, and that all gets collected into the lagoon. And even if we had 2 months drought, we'd still be able to irrigate everything we need in here.
And Lucy, I know, would like to know about more about the production. You're obviously sending that down to the restaurants mostly. And is it just that relationship just with your own restaurants? It's not going anywhere else?
So far, yeah. So we work really closely with the chefs and find out what they want. And then we organise our production based on their needs and menus. At the moment, it is definitely just them. In the future, possibly, we might consider doing some wholesale, especially with produce like lemongrass, which we can produce kilos and kilos of it. Mm. And that's something most people would be importing from abroad.
Absolutely. And quite a high value crop as well. Exactly. So worth it commercially. Yeah. How many tons of tomatoes? I know you said how many tons of tomatoes you produce, and I know Lucy's got hers in her greenhouse. So how many tons are you producing? We'll compare to her.
Well, we're aiming for 2.5 tons of tomatoes this year.
Wow. And you'll probably use those will probably mostly all be used in the restaurant. That's how many people you're getting through.
Yeah, that will all go for the restaurants at the height of summer, yeah.
Wow. And is it various, for? I didn't ask you actually, I meant to when we were having a wander around. Is it various varieties you're using? Are they aesthetic or is it taste? Or what are the chefs wanting the most out of their tomatoes?
They really like heritage tomatoes, yeah. So we've got about 9 different varieties. So a mixture of beefsteak, heritage, and also salad tomatoes.
Right, so yeah, so a good range. And I saw the cucumbers were all Bella. Is that a good grower in here? We're always looking for a good cucumber on the Talking Heads podcast.
Right, yeah, so I've been told that this one is very resistant to pests and powdery mildew.
Oh, interesting.
So I will let you know if how it goes. So we did 2 different varieties last year and had a bit of a headache with pests, Fripps and powdery mildew. So I'm hoping Bella's going to live up to expectations.
And I'm sure you're going to have more and more hurdles, and that's the excitement, isn't it, of growing in a new space, finding out what you can get away with. Is there something you're personally looking forward to getting out of the space the most? Is there something you really enjoy looking and growing in here?
I think I'm particularly excited about the tropical produce. Seeing what we can grow, I'd love to think that one day we'll be producing Cornish avocados and mangoes and produce like that. Obviously, we wouldn't be growing enough for the restaurants, but maybe we could do special avocado events. Or
yes, look out for it, guys. The Eden Project Avocado Day coming soon. Well, thank you, Flo. That's brilliant. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how this develops over the next few years. I'm very lucky to be on the doorstep, so I'm sure we'll be coming back in a few years. So thanks very much.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Well, there you go, Lucy. What was it? 6,000 tons. It must have been at least, 60, 70 tons of tomatoes.
Yeah.
I think they're slightly outdoing you.
Well,
don't forget,
my mum and dad were commercial tomato growers back in the day. So,
good point.
You know, I have picked my way through many, many crates of tomatoes in my youth. But these days I do hone down my skills into one small greenhouse rather than a big commercial one.
Well, you're not having to supply
an 8x10 greenhouse.
You're not having to supply kitchens that are supplying tens of thousands of visitors.
Do you know what though? I would have loved to have done that as a job, to have a kitchen garden or a productive space like they do, and actually have it so you're producing food for the masses. Because I think if you're growing food, it needs to be eaten. And I love the connection you must have with your chefs and like honing recipes and getting seasonal food out there. I think that, so if anyone's doing that, I have serious job envy. So, you know, well done you. I'm sure it's immensely satisfying.
I had immense envy over their new growing space. I got those greenhouses were brand spanking new and they all looked lovely and clean. And it's like that space. It's like when you first have your greenhouse, like you had and I had.
Mm.
And it's like, look what I can do in here, all this stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And then about 5 years later, everything's gone green. There's old compost sacks
in the
corner. Yeah, yeah. There's gravel all over everywhere. And you're thinking, where did that come from? And then you go to a new space and you think, I wish it was like this. Just needs a bit of a sweep up my greenhouse. But lovely.
Mine does too. Do you know, I cleaned it out really well the other year. I think last year, and I haven't had time to do it this year because of Australia, and I'm not complaining because who would not want 3 weeks in Australia? But it has meant my spring has been a bit squished. But yeah, how lovely for them to have had that as a resource and to grow, vast amounts of food. So mum and dad did it commercially, but not directly to the consumer,
yeah,
as it
didn't
were.
Know where
it was sold
going.
To wholesale.
Yeah, yeah.
But this that would be a lovely interaction of liaising with the chefs and staff.
Yeah, so. We'll see how it goes over the years.
Oh, but just as an add-in, pesto pasta for tea tonight with homegrown carrot tops along with basil and also some spinach that I'd put, all from the freezer. So I'm still having homegrown food. It's just from the freezer.
Oh, brilliant.
So, but not 6.5 tonnes worth. Just a small a small container's worth.
Mr. Chamberlain only eats a ton. Anyway, talking of food, we've had a very interesting question on Instagram, haven't we?
Yes, I've had a lovely message from Katie Ellsworth. So she's on Instagram and she asked me the other day, would you please talk a little bit about perennial vegetables and perhaps recommend a few varieties?
Ah.
So, yeah. Yeah, so I can absolutely do that. Katie, you did have another question. We'll get to that hopefully at the end. But the perennial vegetables is something that my ears picked up at because I've been doing some research lately and a lot of it did cover perennial vegetables. Now, you're asking for some recommendations. There's obviously the main ones that we all know and love. So things like asparagus, which, again, mum and dad grew that commercially. I've got many years of harvesting asparagus for the customers who used to come on site. We used to cut it, bundle it up, and people would come up in their cars to mum and dad's and buy asparagus. And that was a lovely crop to grow. It is quite space hungry.
Yeah, but nothing better than a fresh asparagus. It just does not taste the same from the supermarket. I can really tell you, it is really something you need to grow yourself to get the best flavour.
It's really sweet. When you grow it yourself, it's really sweet. That's one thing I noticed about it. And the flavour is very fresh and almost pea-like. Mm. But obviously, there's got massive big tones of asparagus going all over as well. So the only thing I'd say about that, Katie, is it's space hungry. I think a lot of these perennial veg, the thing to just very quickly get in there, probably first of all, actually, is that perennial vegetables, some of them can crop heavily, others not quite so. So we'll talk about that. But the most important thing with them all, I think, is to make sure that the soil that they go into is weed-free in the first place, specifically perennial weeds. Because if you have a perennial vegetable bed, then it gets invaded with things like cooch or bindweed or ground elder. It is very difficult to eradicate because we have this at home. We have a patch of ground elder, and I've actually moved now my perennial veg out of that area. My rhubarb and my asparagus have gone to a completely different area that I know is weed free, and the weedy area I now dig over every spring. I've put barriers there to stop the ground elder hopping over, and because I can dig the area over each spring, if it does hop over a little bit, I can clear it through, get rid of all the growth of the ground elder, and start with a clear bed that I will annually keep clearing. So that's just a little tip if you are struggling with perennial weeds, because I know they can be a nuisance. But yeah, getting back to the veg, things like sea kale. It's a lovely perennial vegetable. Sea kale from a maritime environment is very happy in a drier situation in full sun. Also, so is scorzonera. So that's a perennial veg that has also got some kind of, you know, maritime origins to it. So bear that in mind. Asparagus too. All these vegetables are very happy in free-draining, slightly drier soil. Yes, they will do better if you feed them. But saying that, they are more tolerant of the drought. Also, globe artichokes. Now, again, this is a beautiful vegetable that gives you the most minuscule yield compared to the space that you afford it. But we can let globe artichokes off because they are so stunning. Such a really architectural plant.
They've got
they?
That ornamental value and very good for pollinators. If you see a head of globe artichoke, it'll be full of bees when you get those lovely purple flowers. And not just the flowers, actually, the leaves are quite ornamental. It does well in a sort of mixed potager style garden where you want that little bit silvery sort of glaucous foliage coming through as well. So well worth it. But like quite a big, especially when it starts really getting its roots in after a few years, it's quite a big thug. So just remember that when you're planting these things in. Like you said, not just the weed free, just think about these plants they can take up a fair amount of space in the long run. So it's worth thinking about the beds you use them in and how the space is dictated. Yeah. Yeah.
And cardoons are like globe artichokes on steroids, grown for their blanched stems, so not so much for their flower heads, which actually are smaller. Because we used to have cardoons in the cool border at the hall. And so they would easily get to about 10 foot tall. And the flower heads are, I bet you probably could eat them, but it's just the size, it's not worth it. But you blanch the stems of those. So that's a couple or two or three there that would be happy in hotter, drier conditions. If you're a forager, you could go also for Alexanders. But I know that's a good crop, especially at this time of year when the young growth springs through. At this time, it's all lush and verdant and tender. But I do think it's just massively invasive. The way that self-seeds, it's completely swamped out and suppressed all the cow parsley or sheep's parsley, depending on your colloquial term, that we have here in our village. That's gone. And we've got Alexanders everywhere. So, you know, I mention that with caution.
It's very common along our Devon hedgerows down here. They really love it, but it is quite a big plant actually in the end. You know, it can be quite dominant, and just be careful if you are wild foraging it. There are a lot of the apiaces that look similar but really aren't edible, so just be a bit mindful. Generally the Alexander's a little bit more golden in color and quite early in the season, but if you're not sure, just watch yourselves on that one.
If in doubt, don't, whenever you're foraging for anything, because as you rightly say, Saul, the umbelliferous plants are really tricky to tell apart, and there's others as well. So it's like when you talk about mushroom foraging in the autumn or in the spring for morels, you know, I guess a morel is pretty obvious, but other things in the autumn, if you're not sure, please just don't, because it's not worth it. You can cause all sorts of long-term damage to yourself. You might not feel the symptoms straight away, but sometimes these things can be cumulative. So
absolutely.
We love a forage, don't get us wrong, but you've got to know your stuff. You really have. I was going to talk also about maybe some perennial veg that would be happier in more of a woodland setting.
Okay.
Because there's quite a few. Because I know a lot of us think we get a bit depressed about shade, or we think, oh, it limits what you grow. It really doesn't. It's just you've got to think of plants that maybe are naturally from, you know, sort of forest areas or from woodland edgings and margins and hedgerows, that kind of thing. So there's quite a few perennial veg that are happy there. So, and Saul, if you've grown any of these, do shout out. So hostas are edible. Solomon seal is edible.
So, oh, is it? What yes. new this now with hostas, and I'm guessing with Solomon seals, it is the newer shoots.
It is. They're much more tender and less fibrous. So so those are definitely worth a go. The thing with them is that they're slow growing and they're slow to bulk up. So again, they're not going to give you, like, you know, armfuls of shoots. And also you've got to keep some for ornamental purposes. So
quite common in, I think, Oriental Asian cooking, especially hostas.
Well, also fiddlehead ferns. So I would say they're the shuttlecock fern. Now, again, you have to eat these whilst they are young. And also fiddlehead ferns, they need to be cooked because they have compounds in them that you don't want to be eating when they're raw, but cooked, perfectly fine. So, you know, that's something that, again, in Asian cuisine, that's really popular. Wasabi.
Oh, yeah. We all know about wasabi. There is a wasabi grower in... Let me just say that if you get wasabi from generally from a restaurant or a supermarket, it I'm afraid to say it's not usually wasabi, the root ground up. It is usually horseradish, sometimes with a little bit of colouring in it, and they're telling you lies, I'm afraid. But there is wasabi in this country that's being grown alongside the watercress industry in Hampshire, and it's an incredibly secretive place. Actually, I haven't actually managed to visit, but it's an interesting, very interesting crop. It almost looks like a gunnera.
It's really
kind
ornamental.
Of thing. Yeah,
it's smaller, but very structural.
But very
and
structural.
It loves flowing water.
That's it. That's why the watercress.
If you can give it flowing water, like watercress, you know, it's that kind of thing. So, yeah, I'm going to open this one to you because I know you grow this wild garlic.
It is a staple down here in the West Country. It's become reasonably invasive. I have to say that. I think it's a very beautiful woodland plant. Incredibly robust. It will grow through anything. But the great thing about it is you can eat every single part of the plant. So the leaf is obviously very widely used now. Everyone knows it's called ransoms down here, if you've ever hear that term. The leaves are very garlicky, but you can eat the roots. There is a little sort of garlicky clove down there. You can eat the flowers, edible flowers, but the bit that I really like, and I don't think is eaten that much, is the seed pods. They're very much, you can pickle them like capers, and they have a very mild garlic taste, and I absolutely love them. So
that sounds lovely.
It does. Do you know, I don't know why it, well, I do know why it isn't grown widely, because it is, you've got, I always give someone a clump and I give them the proviso, you will have about 2 acres by the time you finish. It also does need it. It does need it slightly moist. That's why it does very well down in the West Country. I'm not sure how well it will do on your sandy soil. I think it will struggle. But a beautiful plant.
I'd have to mollycoddle it. Mm. I'd have to put it somewhere shady and moist, because as I say, that's why it does so well for you. Mm. But then I guess in that sense, it wouldn't be so invasive for us. We'd have to, not be maybe so mindful of that, she says, with a good dollop of sarcasm and caution.
A really good alternative for basil in pesto is wild garlic leaves. It tastes delicious.
I would, do you know what? I would like to grow wild garlic, and if I grew it, I would grow it sunken into a bucket, just to make sure it doesn't spread. I've done that with my. So this is another one quickly for you. Horseradish is another one that's very. And horseradish is happy in that tricky situation of dry shade. Horseradish is quite good there. So I'm going to just very quickly mention rhubarb, because I'm talking about moist shade and plants that like that. So rhubarb would be another great one to grow. And obviously people are forcing rhubarb left, right and centre. At this very, very moment, you can hear the stems cracking. The candles are lit.
The rhubarb, is it a triangle? It is a triangle, isn't it?
It's a triangle. Well done.
I thought it was a. I'm motioning on the camera different shapes, because I suddenly thought it was a square, but that might be an asparagus thing. I think the rhubarb is a triangle, if I remember rightly.
The rhubarb is a triangle, yes. Yes, you're right. You're right. Now, dry shade. Okay, so there are some veg perennials that will colonize dry shade. So these are all something. I really strongly feel that you've got to put your veg and your fruit in the right place. So this is why I'm banging on about, putting it in these particular areas, because I think we should all think about that. So nettles, perennial nettles. Nettles in the spring. I passed a guy walking his dog the other day and we had a lovely conversation, because he was foraging. He'd been down to the seawall, because where we are is an estuary, and he'd got some sea beet, which he was saying was delicious, but also he'd got nettles. And we were talking about Alexanders, but nettles, this time of year, that young growth coming through, gosh, they're so healthy. They really are good for cleaning your blood. They're like a detoxifying plant, full of iron. They're very, very good. So obviously you've got to master a technique for picking them without getting stung. Gloves is a way forward. But you can also, I've noticed that the stems below soil level, just that little kind of like inch or so below soil level, there's no stinging hairs there. There's none of these, the trichomes. So you're fine.
And just this has got nothing to do with food, but just to add, older nettles, as they get more mature, you can actually turn them into a weaving thread. My partner's very big knitter and things, and she's been looking up alternatives for differing thread types to knit
the fibers.
With. Yeah. Fibers, that's it. And nettles has come up. So I find that fascinating that some plants different ethnobotanical roles, not just food, but also for clothing and all sorts, fuel, you name it.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, food, dyes, all sorts. Hop shoots, if you wanted to. Again, these are like the sort of like the young Solomon seal shoots. You want to get them whilst they're tender. But hops, again, is really, vigorous and would be happy in a drier situation. So bamboo. So bamboo shoots like Phyllostachys, if you want one that's a bit more clumpy rather than too invasive. The young, what's the name of the shoots as they come through?
It's not Colms.
Colm, thank you very much.
C-U-L-M, there
that's
we go.
The yeah. Thank you so much. Thank you. The young colms are like we buy tins of bamboo shoots, so it's exactly that. I've mentioned horseradish. There's something called monk's rhubarb or patient's dock, which is a type of dock. It is a type of rumex that also likes the or will be happy in dry shade, because it develops a big taproot like horseradish does and comfrey. All these things that develop a big taproot. they are more drought resilient and they draw up minerals from deep within the soil. They're very good at extracting nutrients from deep within that other plants can't reach. Have you found it yet? Because you've got a frowny face.
Sorry, I'm on Google because I've never heard of that. It's a Rumex. It's in Polygonaceae, so it's
dock. Exactly, it's a dock. It is a dock, but it's a more palatable dock with wider leaves. And it still has oxalic acid in it, like a lot of the spinaches and the sorrels and the Rumex do. But if you blanch them, you can actually use it like to wrap up.
Mm.
Like, say, savoury rice, or when you do vine leaves and things like that, you can use it that way.
Yeah.
Oh, Caucasian spinach. There you go. Hablitzia. Now, I am wanting to grow that this year because that's one that I want to try. So that's another one. So that's your hardy perennial veg. There's lots of tender ones as well, but I'm only going to very briefly talk about them because we're running out of time. But if you're still wanting to grow some tender perennials, obviously there's loads, but things that really catch my imagination is a perennial basil. African blue basil is a one that you can overwinter in a greenhouse. You can take cuttings, but it will, unlike other basils, it will keep on growing as a true perennial. Aloe vera, you can actually take the skins off the aloe vera because those are very bitter and not very pleasant, but the sort of jelly pith inside can be used to make a really refreshing and nutritional drink, so that's worth going. And then we've got things like dahlias, Oxalis triangularis, which is a little houseplant that you can have. That's a perennial. That's got a lovely little sorrel-like, or a shamrock-style leaf with a sort of vinegary, tart taste. So, honestly, I know I've gone off the... I'm guessing you were talking more about hardy perennial vegetables there, but there's loads of tender ones, too, that can be grown. So, I hope that answers the question. So, Katie, you were also asking about how do you use a hoe?
I think it's all about when you use a hoe more than how you use your hoe. Because I'm going to say that there's a lot of different types of hoes. I prefer a pull hoe. I like a Dutch hoe or one that's got a blade at an angle. And I just like the motion of going backwards. I don't know. When I'm going down the rows of veg, I generally like to go backwards than forwards. Maybe that's just something you can get obviously the push Dutch hose, but it's when you hoe is so important that you do it on a day where the weeds are going to instantly desiccate and die. That's basically what you're trying to achieve. So on nice warm days where there's not much moisture in that sort of top layer, and you can just work the hoe through very lovely. It just skims through. You take off the top. So what you're doing with hoeing is you're detaching the roots and the top growth. You don't want to be dragging any hose around, so make sure your hose is nice and sharp. And then
It's got to be sharp. That's really important.
Got to be sharp. And then detach those top growth, and then they desiccate instantly, and then you get rid of stuff. It does work well, the most well with annual or ephemeral weeds. Generally with perennials, it depends on the stage of growth that. Sometimes you're just taking the tops off of dandelions and they regrow. So it's worth... Also, when you get to hoeing, knowing what weeds you're hoeing. So it's there's a multiple strands there to hoeing. But in general, make sure you do it when it's nice and the sun is out. And it's a bit like 2022 when it was quite warm. That was good hoeing weather. You don't want to be doing it when it's too moist.
I think because we're running out of time, I concur exactly with what you're saying. And I would also just maybe say, as you say, if it's windy, if you can, leave it a few hours before you hoe, if the soil has been wet, just to allow it to haze off a little bit. Because if that top millimetre or four of soil is dry, then the hoe will not bury itself into the ground. It will bounce over the top. You just want that slight crust on the top of the soil, because otherwise, like you say, if you're trying to hoe in wet conditions now, you're just going to be... The hoe will naturally just want to sort of bury itself into the soft, lovely soil. So, and interestingly, I like a draw hoe to make a drill when I'm making my seed drill, but I like a Dutch hoe when I'm hoeing weeds. So there you go.
There you go. There's all different
potato,
types.
Potato, potato, tomato, tomato.
Yeah. Just find which one you like, Rachel. And, some people like it on a long pole. Some people like it hand hoeing. There's also
an onion hoe. Can't beat an onion hoe.
Absolutely. And hoeing is a fantastic weed removal way, in my opinion, especially on the right day. Anyway, hopefully we've answered your question. A lot to fit into that episode. I hope you are all welcome that we're back. Next week we have a special interview with someone, so we've got more people coming on.
But
this is what we're doing now. It's what's happening next week. It's so much more important what's happening this. So anyway, yeah, get out into your garden, get out with your hose, and have a bit of fun, and hopefully, fingers crossed, the weather's with us.
That takes us to the end of today's episode. We thoroughly enjoyed your company for the last 30 minutes, and we hope you'll join us again next time for more insights into our gardening lives. If you'd like to leave a review or offer us feedback, you can do so via your podcast provider or our social media platforms. You can find me on Instagram at headgardenerlc and Saul on Twitter at gardeningsaul.
As we hunker down during long winter evenings, the lengthening days will offer us a boost in energy levels, ready to greet the new gardening year. Before we know it, we'll be dusting down our propagators, being treated to vibrant displays of spring bulbs, and heading to the garden centres and plant fairs, list in hand, to track down those must-grow plants.
So, until the next episode of Talking Heads, goodbye!
Goodbye!